Today is Thursday, February 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, families who've lost loved ones to gun violence give tearful pleas to the president.
I was on the second floor in that building, texting my mom, texting my dad, texting three of my brothers, that I was never going to see him again.
In Syria, we renewed violence being described as hell on earth.
Over the past 2 weeks, at least 1,200 civilian casualties have been documented.
An evangelical icon has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Spilling out wrenching tales of lost lives and stolen security, students and parents appealed to President Donald Trump Wednesday to set politics aside and protect American schoolchildren from the scourge of gun violence. Andrew Pollock, whose daughter Meadow was killed last week, noted the previous school massacres and raged over his loss, saying, "This moment isn't about gun laws, but about fixing the schools."
My daughter has no voice. She was murdered last week when she was taken from us. Shot 9 times on the third floor. We, as a country, failed our children. This shouldn't happen. We go to the airport. I can't get on a plane with a bottled water, but we leave it. Some animal could walk into a school and shoot our children.
And Samuel Zeif, a tearful student at the high school, said he woke up to the news that his best friend was gone.
"And I don't understand why I could still go in a store and buy a weapon of war, an AR. I was reading today that a person 20 years old walked into a store and bought an AR-15 in 5 minutes with an expired ID. How is it that easy to buy this type of weapon? How do we not stop this after Columbine, after Sandy Hook? I'm sitting with a mother that lost her son. It's still happening."
Well, President Trump listened intently to the raw emotion and pledged action, including the possibility of arming teachers, other school employees, and other school employees to carry concealed weapons to be ready for intruders.
"And it would be teachers and coaches, if the coach had a firearm in his locker when he ran at this guy. That coach was very brave, saved a lot of lives, I suspect. But if he had a firearm, he wouldn't have had a run. He would have shot, and that would have been the end of it."
The president had invited the teen survivors of school violence and parents of murdered children in a show of his resolve against gun violence in the wake of last week's shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida and in past years at Newtown, Connecticut and Littleton, Colorado. The latest episode has prompted a renewed and growing call for stronger gun control. Trump invited his guests to suggest solutions and solicited feedback. He didn't fully endorse any specific policy solution, but pledged to take action and expressed interest in widely differing approaches. Meanwhile, in a wave of demonstrations reaching from Arizona to Maine, students at dozens of high schools walked out of class Wednesday to protest gun violence and honor the victims last week's deadly shooting in Florida. Protests spread from school to school as students shared plans for their demonstrations over social media. American Christian evangelist Billy Graham, often viewed as the most influential preacher of the 20th century, died Wednesday at the age of 99. VOA's Jeff Custer reports from Washington.
"Come to know Christ for yourself. There's a peace."
Graham, for decades, held a Bible as he preached to more than 200 million people in 185 countries and territories. He staged massive rallies, the Billy Graham Crusades, that were attended by thousands of people and reached millions more via TV and satellite links. During 7 decades of preaching, Graham declared that the belief and acceptance of Jesus Christ was the only answer to humanity's troubles.
"This crowd has been brought together, I believe, by the Spirit of God."
The evangelist was a spiritual advisor and acquaintance of every U.S. president, from Harry Truman in the 1940s to Barack Obama in recent years. Graham was often asked to pray or preach at public national U.S. events, such as the inaugurations of new presidents. U.S. President Donald Trump commented on Graham's death via Twitter Wednesday, saying there was no one like him. Speaking Wednesday at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, Vice President Mike Pence noted Graham's influence on American society.
You know, today our nation awoke to the sad news of the passing of one of the greatest Americans of the 20th century, the Reverend Billy Graham. His ministry and his matchless voice changed the lives of millions and inspired our nation.
Graham conducted crusades on every continent except Antarctica, in person and via satellite. As a result of his world travels, the quintessential American preacher concluded that Christianity is no longer a strictly white, Western religion.
Christianity is not a white man's religion, and don't let anybody ever tell you that it's white or black. Christ belongs to all people.
Graham, who had been suffering from a variety of ailments in recent years, was rarely seen in public. He died early Wednesday at his home in North Carolina. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
The shattered Damascus suburbs of eastern Ghouta have become the focus of some of the most vicious Russian and Syrian government bombardments of Syria's civil war. The carnage and destruction have left more than 300 people dead and hundreds more wounded this week. And as doctors struggle to save lives and amputate limbs in crude makeshift clinics amid blast tremors, rebels are preparing for a government ground assault. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council is expected to vote possibly later today on a draft resolution demanding a 30-day ceasefire to allow for humanitarian aid and medical evacuations. Hundreds are apparently in need. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described the carnage and urged the parties to allow for the evacuation of the 700 people urgently awaiting medical attention.
I am deeply saddened by the terrible suffering of the civilian population in eastern Ghouta, 400,000 people that live in hell on earth.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks, Anthony Billingsley, Middle East senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales, what's behind this latest unfolding tragedy?
One of the big things is Assad's sense that he's winning, and given the Russians' involvement in this appalling process, that the Russian commitment is strong. There is an element to which Putin has been very pragmatic over the Syrian conflict and Middle Eastern issues generally. But here he seems to be digging in with the Syrians. So they're very confident that they can get away with what they're doing. Russia will veto any Security Council resolution they don't like. You know, it's a real thorn. It's right there next to the capital. And without wanting to diminish the appalling nature of what the Syrian government is doing, the other side is also lobbing mortars and things into Damascus, which means that basically the population is being held hostage by the two sides. So I guess, you know, for the Syrian government to allow rebels to continue to attack it from such a close area is something that they can't tolerate. And it seems that they've just gone for the all-or-nothing approach to just blast the everybody out, perhaps trying to force civilians to try to escape if they can.
They're willing to withstand the public relations disaster in the international community that this seems to be developing into, the UN Secretary General calling it hell on earth for civilians.
Well, that's right. That's right. But, of course, they've been accused of all sorts of things like chemical weapons use, etc., in the past. And, you know, they just seem to shrug it off. I think probably domestic and regime considerations outweigh international opprobrium.
How likely is a 30-day ceasefire? How likely will this UN resolution pass?
I guess it depends on what it entails. Why would the Syrians and the Russians ease up on what they're doing if, you know, they can sense that their opponents are starting to weaken in the face of this? So it's, you know, it's a matter of what's in it for the Syrians and what's in it for the Russians. And it's hard to see what a ceasefire could offer them at the moment.
They're likening this to Aleppo, where they negotiated a rebel withdrawal. Is that likely what will happen in eastern Ghouta?
Well, I suppose that's possible, but where are they going to withdraw to? I mean, they've now turned their attention to Idlib, which was where all the rebels from Aleppo were relocated. So, you know, you can't send these people to Idlib province. Where are they going to go? Are they just going for an absolute victory and, you know, and that'll be that? Or maybe they'll let the fighters leave the country.
Further north in Syria, Turkey warned Wednesday that pro-Damascus forces would face, quote, serious consequences for entering Syria's Afrin region to help Kurdish fighters repel a Turkish offensive. How serious a matter is this?
This is the most extraordinary, extraordinary turn of events, isn't it, where you have a foreign country invading another country and telling that country for its armed forces to keep out. That country, which the US and others has condemned, is talking about protecting Kurds who happen to be allies of the United States. You talk about a complicated mix of alliances and loyalties. I suspect that the Syrian government is happy enough to go after rebels, but when it comes to the very significant armed forces that Turkey can bring to bear and the much more complex relationship that exists between Turkey and the United States and others, for example, that they're probably going to make a show, but it's hard to imagine that they would take on the Turkish armed forces.
Do you expect Turkey to be there for a long period of time? They've taken a lot of losses in their offensive.
They have, haven't they? And that's perhaps going to way against Erdogan, although his popularity remains stratospherically high. But, you know, the Turks did the same sort of thing, if you like, in northern Iraq many years ago, and they're still there in various forms. So I think they're, you know, they have the capacity to withstand losses. I mean, what they'll try and do is to just sort of stabilize the situation and ensure that the Kurdish forces aren't able to form any sort of coherent opposition to them, and then they can basically sit tight.
We're approaching the 7th anniversary of this conflict. Years have gone by. We thought both sides, the rebels and the government forces, would be exhausted, and this fighting would just peter out. But it just seems to be like a phoenix reappearing again.
I think what's happening now is that the range or the scope of the fighting has shrunk. So you now have a number of hot spots. Eastern Ghouta is one of them. The area south of Damascus could turn into one. We've seen possible incidents there between the Israelis and Syria, for example, and the Idlib area. And the rest of it, the violence seems to have reduced considerably. We're seeing much more concentrated activity. As the Mastura commented the other night, that there are more people in eastern Ghouta trapped than there were in Aleppo. So in some respects, you know, this is a much more concentrated but serious issue.
That's Anthony Billingsley, Middle East Senior Lecturer at the University of New South Wales. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Corruption monitors paint a grim picture in Africa for 2017. Social taboos, lack of awareness is contributing to child sex abuse in Pakistan. Israel counters Iran's new missile with a successful interceptor test. And a new report finds Somali authorities abuse children linked to al-Shabaab. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Political parties in Cameroon have set an ambitious goal ahead of this year's polls to put women in at least 30% of elected offices. Mucky Edwin Kinzega reports from Yaoundé.
An all-female orchestra plays as 300 women selected from associations around Cameroon campaign in markets, universities, and popular spots in the capital, asking women to register to vote. 29-year-old fish seller Clarice Kongyu says she agreed to register because the women convinced her that with hard work, she might even one day be on the ballot.
We can be able to do what a man can do, to be given posts that the world feels as it's only for men. There are women who are mechanics. There are women who are driving caterpillars and all the like. But at first they thought that that was just the job of a man. The problem is that some of the women are not pushed for. They are like sleeping.
Cameroon will be having a series of important elections this year, local, parliamentary, and presidential. Political parties, including the main opposition SDF and the ruling CPDM, have taken public commitments to achieve a UN-established benchmark of at least 30% female representation. The government has echoed the commitment, calling on parties to put forth an adequate number of female candidates. The first election of the year is the senatorial, scheduled for March 25th. To meet the gender goal, women would need to win at least 20 of the 70 senatorial seats up for grabs, while President Paul Biya would have to include women among the 30 senators that the Constitution calls on him to appoint. Observers say the odds of success are long, at least in the short term. Cameroon has 386 mayors. Just 26 are women. In the National Assembly, women occupy one-third of the seats in the lower house, while the upper house is just 20% women. Female members of the ruling CPDM party say women should not be discouraged. Senator Julien Janku of Cameroon's far north region says many women are not able to participate in decision-making because of traditional misconceptions and early marriage, which derails their education.
On pensait que quand tu es chrétien, tu ne vas pas faire la politique. On se rapprochait du cardinal.
She says she did not believe it when men in her community said the Bible prohibits women from participating in politics, and so she went to seek advice from the highest member of the Roman Catholic Church in Cameroon, Cardinal Christian Toumi. She says he told her that politics was for both men and women. But some male politicians argue women aren't ready and that Cameroon needs to get more women to vote before it can get more women in office. Women constitute 52% of the country's population. Yet, according to official figures, women account for just 30% of the 7 million people registered to vote in this year's polls. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, online dating has grown to be a very popular way to find love in this day and age, and so it's not completely surprising that there is now one site that's facing a lawsuit, this one regarding the app Tinder, amid discrimination charges. Joining us now is attorney Angela Reddock-Wright with Los Angeles-based Reddock Law Group. What exactly is this all about?
Well, in this case, the California Court of Appeal found that Tinder violated a California law. It's called the Jess Unruh Act and the Unfair Claims Act in their business practices, where they created a different pricing system for younger users or users under the age of 30, and then for older users over the age of 30. And for younger users, they charge $9.99, you know, for the minimum service, and for older users, $19.99. And the court found that there was no reasonable basis, there was no public policy support for differentiating between younger and older users. And Tinder argued, well, market research shows that, you know, older workers would be willing to pay more versus, not workers, older users would be willing to pay more, whereas younger users possibly can't afford to pay more. And the court said, despite that market research, if it's even true, did not lend a justification for making that differential, and that it was really discrimination against older people.
Who brought on this lawsuit?
It's Alan Calandori, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. And he's known as a men's rights activist, and he actually has filed suits in the past against women's organizations, for example, that will have, you know, women's business networking groups, for example, that may have women's only networking groups. So he's actually sued, saying that that's gender discrimination based on his being male, and he's been successful in some of his suits. So he's the one that brought this, and some arguments are, while it's a great decision, that, you know, perhaps the individual that brought it may not be the best representative of the issue, just because in some circles he's seen as a serial kind of filer and as someone who doesn't necessarily support women's rights.
But do you think Tinder was actually trying to sort of get more younger people on the site and less older people, and that's why they made the price more expensive for older people?
It's definitely possible. The rationale of younger people possibly can't afford it at the level, or they wouldn't, because there's so many options available to them that perhaps they would not pay $19.99 as opposed to $9.99.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, it sends the wrong message in our society that we should differentiate between people based on their age. So I think the court got it right that, you know, despite the business decision, and I'm sure these kind of decisions are made every day in business, even if they don't come to the forefront, but despite whatever the business rationale is, this is not the type of issue, who you date and being able to use the site for dating, to differentiate between age. And in fact, you know, there's an argument also that because you're older, it may be more difficult to meet people. And so perhaps we should discount the price for older people, so, you know, to entice them to use technology and to use, especially older people who are not used to technology, to entice them to use the technology as a way of finding their mate. So I think the court got it right.
How unprecedented is something like this, and do you think it could lead the way for more like this when it comes to online dating issues?
Possibly. I imagine that with the Tinder decision, that to the extent any other sites do this, that they will change their policies and their practices. But I think it certainly sends a positive message to everyone that's somewhat skeptical of online dating, that there are protections there, and that even in online dating, like we have with work and so many other scenarios, that there are protections for individuals based on age. And I would say this probably extends into race and all of the other protections that we have in our society as well. So it sends the right message, not just for this industry, but for our entire country, where we have issues of age discrimination.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Attorney Angela Reddock, right, with Los Angeles-based Reddock Law Group. Thanks for being with us. A well-known rapper has a new single out, along with an inspiring video. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
Today, it's a new song from Drake off of a brand new EP that he's just put out called Scary Hours. And this song is called God's Plan, and it's number one on Billboard this week.
She say, do you love me? I tell her only partly. I only love my bed and my mom. I'm sorry. 50 dub, I even got it tatted on me. 81, they'll bring the crashers to the party.
Tell us a bit about this song, Larry.
Well, Sarah, this is the 29th song in music history to debut at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. It's Drake's fourth number one song in the U.S., his second as a solo artist. It debuted at number one in Canada and also in the UK as well, giving him his second number one single as a lead artist in London, in the UK. And in addition to that, the new song comes with a great music video in which Drake is up and down the streets of Miami, Florida, passing out money to people, real money. This wasn't just a stunt. He passed out $1 million in various different denominations to people going by. And Drake apparently has an affinity for Miami, even though he lives in Toronto, Canada. He donated $50,000 to a scholarship fund at the University of Miami to help out a student there. And he's donated other money for Miami school funds and whatnot. And he said he wants people to be nice to one another, even if it's just for 24 hours. But that's the new video, the number one song, and it's from Drake, who has been absent for a little bit, but we're glad that he's back. And so the song is called God's Plan.
And probably one of the reasons he likes Miami is it's a lot warmer there than it is in Canada this time of the year.
That's very true. That's very less shoveling.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
God's plan. God's plan. I can't do this on my own. Hey, nope. Hey. Someone watching it close. Yep, close. I've been me since Scarlet Road. Hey, bro. Hey. Might go down as G-O-D. Yep.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's health, education, agriculture, and governance sectors will get an extra assist from the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $89 million in additional development assistance to Nigeria to continue its support for development goals outlined in a Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments signed in 2015. Nearly half of the new funding, $44 million, will support HIV/AIDS control through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. The remainder will help Northeast Nigeria increase agricultural productivity, economic growth, and resilience through the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative, strengthen education, support good governance, and improve water and sanitation infrastructure. The new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year assistance agreement to $808.5 million. USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts, among others, to structure the bilateral assistance agreement, which runs through 2020. In addition to the development assistance funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The U.S. government, led by USAID, has provided more than $526.7 million in humanitarian assistance since 2017 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. This new assistance underscores how important the relationship between Nigeria and the United States continues to be. USAID Nigeria Deputy Assistant Administrator Julie Conan said, "Our strong partnership with Nigeria and its institutions will help Nigeria's efforts to improve its health, education, agriculture, and governance systems where they are needed most throughout the country."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.